This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Tonight, our theme is art and activism. In the first half of the program, we'll be talking with Basia Ireland, a New Mexico artist who works in the field, creating spaces and artworks that inform and engage environmentalists.
And then we'll speak with Ontario artist Corey Trepanier, who does wilderness treks, carrying his easel, paints, and camera to document Canada's wild spaces.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Digital Path, providing a high-speed internet and telephone for homes and businesses throughout the North State. Specializing in rural and hard-to-reach areas, Digital Path is your locally owned option for the internet with upgraded service plans and expanded coverage areas. Visit digitalpath.net or call toll-free at 1-800-676-PATH for more information. And we're also brought to you by The Printed Image, specializing in custom screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. Using the latest technology in their state-of-the-art building, The Printed Image provides custom screen printing, embroidery, and promotional products for business, organization, or special events. For custom apparel and promotional products, The Printed Image has dedicated specialists providing quality service, quick turnaround, and memorable products. Call 898-9525 or visit printedimagechico.com.
The opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of the staff, board of directors, volunteers, or programmers of KZFR. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Basia Ireland about her ice books. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Tonight, our ecosystem is works of art and how they can intersect with the world of environmental activism. On the phone with us now from New Mexico is Basia Ireland, who does amazing artwork out in the field. She focuses on international water issues, especially rivers, waterborne diseases, and water scarcity. Over the past three decades, she has created projects in Africa, Canada, Europe, South America, Southeast Asia, and the United States.
In addition to being an artist, Basha works with scholars from diverse disciplines, building rainwater harvesting systems, connecting communities, and fostering dialogue along the entire length of rivers, filming and producing water documentaries, creating waterborne disease projects around the world, most recently in Egypt, Ethiopia, India, and Nepal. Welcome, Basha Erland.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and thank you for that introduction. It's actually raining here in Albuquerque, so this is a perfect time to have this interview.
Okay, beginning of the monsoon season, then.
Yep.
Let's give our listeners some visual radio so they can see the kind of work you do. We first learned of your work from the Ice Books Project, the book called Ice Receding, Books Receding, R-E-S-E-E-D-I-N-G. Please tell us about the ice books. What are they and how are they created?
Well, let's begin with the basics. Blocks of ice, some weighing as much as 300 pounds, while others are a lot smaller, are hand-carved into the form of a book. I work closely with local botanists to decide what are the best native riparian seeds for each region. The riparian zone is the area of land that lines both sides of the river. It's funny because I talk with my hands, so if you could see me, I'm doing this okay. with both of my hands.
We're seeing both sides of the river.
These seeds are then placed into the ice book as a kind of text or an international ecological language. The books are launched into international rivers, and the site-specific seeds are released as the ice melts in the current. Ice Receding, Books Receding, emphasizes the necessity of communal effort, scientific knowledge, and poetic intervention to deal with the complex issues of climate disruption and watershed restoration through the release of seed-laden ephemeral ice sculptures into rivers, creeks, and streams. This project presents a lyrical way to promote positive actions that may have constructive results in helping restore streams anywhere in the world, and provides a model that can be replicated anywhere. The title of this series of projects was originally conceived for Weather Report, a groundbreaking exhibition and catalog about climate change curated by author and cultural critic Lucy Lepard for the Museum of Contemporary Art in Boulder, Colorado. These sculptures depict a problem, melting glaciers, and a suggestion for action, seeding riparian zones to reduce some of the effects of climate change through plants. In future book launches, there are plans to attach a monitoring probe, which would measure temperature, light, and dissolved oxygen, and a microcam so we can watch the seeds progress down the river and view in real time where the current takes them and how the seeds are deposited along the banks. A GPS locator will also be installed in the ice so we can find the data logger and camera.
Really interesting. Why carve the form of a book?
Well, because as a volume, improbably, floats down the river in water, the resonances of knowledge, history, culture, and curiosity, hopefully, buoyantly accompany it. Books are earthy and sculptural, in my mind. When opened, volumes appear as if they could lift off the surface, join a flock of migrating birds, flap their winged pages, and rain down letters on those of us below. When closed, a book is like a sarcophagus, a toolbox waiting to be pried open with descriptive words on three sides, deciphering some of the contents.
And so, Basha Erland, how do you decide which seeds are best for each area where you do the ice books?
Well, stream ecologists, river restoration biologists, and botanists all help to ascertain the best seeds for each specific riparian zone. As you mentioned earlier, as an artist, I work really closely with scientists from all different disciplines. So the seeds form a language of the river, a restoration text. The calligraphic sentences of seeds slide off of the melting pages of the translucent volumes into the water to be carried to shore. In Henry David Thoreau's last book, Faith in a Seed, which was published after he died, he wrote, quote, "Though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where no seed has been, I have great faith in a seed, Convince me that you have a seat there, and I am prepared to expect wonders. End quote. That a tiny, quiet bundle can transform into some enormous cottonwood tree, or a tiny, fragrant lily of the valley, or a thorny cactus, to me anyway, is completely wondrous. Also, I thought for your listeners, I'd just list a few of the ways that plants help riparian zones. Plants sequester carbon. They mitigate floods and drought, pollinate other plants, disperse seeds, create soil regeneration and preservation, act as filters for pollutants and debris, supply leaf litter for food and habitat. It's interesting with leaf litter. I have a friend up who teaches at Evergreen in Washington, which we'll talk about later, and her entire thesis was just on leaf litter. So I've learned a lot about that particular phrase. Promote aesthetic pleasure, hold the banks in place to slow erosion, and provide shelter and shade for riverside organisms, of course, including us humans.
You have such great images and great metaphors for the book and how the book represents various things that you're trying to approach. You also do a lot of research for each project. Can you tell us about research?
Yeah, the role of research about each particular site is paramount and consists of the usual web searches and head-in book investigations, which obviously I spend a lot of time doing. But more informative to me are discussions with tribal elders, scientists, and river citizens who have spent time hanging out with their river, intently paying attention. It has opened my eyes to the depth of knowledge a river accumulates over thousands of years as it traverses the land. Listening and closely observing are invaluable. My riparian projects are not about theorizing while sitting in an armchair or a classroom, but rather about connecting directly and in physical ways with the river. I used to be amazed when I would lecture to advanced undergraduate and graduate classes of 150 students or so in the hydrology department at the University of New Mexico, where I used to teach, about river issues, and ask how many had been to the Rio Grande, which runs right through Albuquerque here. Only three or four hands would go up. How is it possible that even students studying water would not go to our major local river even to witness it? And these were students who specifically study H2O. So I would give an assignment for them to go to the Rio for a day and write or draw or just be present with the flow and report back. How our universities, schools, and communities have become so disconnected from their natural surroundings is a whole other topic, but one that helps propel my work. Getting outside and getting involved with a creek or stream where one lives and knowing where water in the tap comes from are vital activities.
We're really starting to get to the activism part of art and activism. Who participates in your projects?
A lot of different people. Those who contribute or participate in the icebook launches are from the local communities where I'm honored to be invited. And I feel very blessed to have had the invitations that I have all around the world. Participants in New Mexico, for example, on the Rio Grande, have included artists, farmers, acequia mayordomos, hydrologists, filmmakers, physicians, University of New Mexico students and professors, a lot of Pueblo members, and hundreds of interested watershed citizens. Another example is there were 9 different departments and institutes at Antioch College and the University of Dayton, which invited me to create an icebook project in Ohio. This included the Rivers Institute and, much to my surprise, even the physics department. When it came time to place the books into the Miami River, which is the one in Ohio, not in Florida, instead of launching the dozen sculptures from shore, we attached them to the front of a flotilla of kayaks and paddled them out into the current to be released. Along the banks, 100 participants lifted glasses of drinking water toward the river and proposed a toast. Now, this is something that I often do because I do think of rivers as living beings. So what we all said was, May you always flow, and may you always flow clean.
Wow, really beautiful.
Thank you.
There's a lot of time that goes into carving of each sculpture, and I'm really curious about this. does it bother you then that they melt away and disappear?
Not at all. Actually, that is one of the underlying messages of this work. In my art, the process of creation is as important as the sculptures, which in this case are impermanent, only existing after the event through documentation and plans. Part of the significance of the ice books is that they melt away. These impermanent sculptural tomes are vehicles for change. Time and energy, which have gone into the carving of the books, vanish in the current of the stream. Everything, absolutely everything we know is in existence for only a period of time. Instead of dust to dust, here we have water to water. A marble or steel sculpture will also eventually, over millennia, go back into the earth, but the process is speeded up drastically in melting ice. For me, an important aspect is a community-based ethic is gifting. The participants have donated their time, energy, ideas, and enthusiasm to each ice book project. So it is with great joy that I give back by presenting each person with a gift related specifically to the river where we have all worked together. It's that notion of reciprocity.
It really sounds similar, too, to the Buddhist sand mandalas, one of which was constructed here in Chico within the past week.
I have to say something about that.
Go ahead.
I love those. And that is all about impermanence.
Right.
Exactly.
In fact, at the end, they scoop all of the beautiful mandala, and people like gasp as they do
right.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah.
much time right. that, and right. energy that has gone into that. They scoop it. At least when we were here, I've seen two or three of them created. The sand is scooped into vases, and then those vases are then carried down to the river and put into the river. And so for me, as a person who works beside rivers all the time, I have that image so strongly in my mind of the compassion that went into the creation of those mandalas floating by me in the river. So I love that image. I'm glad you brought that up.
We know that you've launched the ice books all over the world, Washington State, Ohio, Wyoming, the Netherlands, but you also do gatherings and repositories to establish working relationships between people and to connect diverse cultures along the entire length of a river, kind of emphasizing that we all live downstream. Tell us about these. What is a gathering of waters?
Well, the gathering of waters establishes cooperative relationships between people and connects diverse cultures along the entire length of rivers, thereby emphasizing that we all live downstream and how imperative it is that we work together to face water challenges. During the 5-year-long gathering of waters, Rio Grande Source to Sea, over 1,000 participants poured a small amount of river water into a canteen, wrote in a logbook about their experience of the river, and passed these downstream to another person along the entire 1,875-mile length of the Rio Grande.
Wow.
That river begins in the San Juan Mountains of southern Colorado, flows through New Mexico, and as we know, it becomes the border between Texas and Mexico, and then enters the Gulf of Mexico at Boca Chica. Boca Chica is one of my favorite places. I love to be down. The canteen and logbook traveled the entire route of the Rio by boat, by raft, canoe, even hot air balloon, car, van, horseback, truck, bicycle, and on foot. Always handed person to person the entire distance.
Nice.
Also, here in New Mexico, and this is one of the things I love about living in New Mexico, there are 19 Native American pueblos along the length of the Rio Grande, and many of them participated in the gathering by performing relays of running with the canteen from pueblo to pueblo. They were usually escorted by tribal police cars.
Nice.
At each pueblo, the arrival of the canteen would be greeted with a delicious, home-cooked native meal. Connections were made that have been lasting, which is very gratifying for me. and groups are working together that never would have met otherwise. The river water in the canteen was continuously decanted into larger containers, and the liquid was eventually dispersed into the Gulf at a grand ceremony with participants from Mexico and the United States and the entire upper and lower basin celebrating together.
So there are a lot of ritual elements to this practice.
Yeah, there are. That's a word that I don't particularly like, but it certainly is used often in reference to my work. So I just accept that, and yes, there are.
Okay.
And you do these things called backpack repositories. Tell us about those.
Well, these are the sculptures that accompany the projects. The backpack repositories are constructed from local materials. My background is as a sculptor, so it was important somehow to take the gatherings into some kind of sculptural form. So they contain artifacts from the various gatherings that have happened in various places. They hold the scientific data, the canteens, logbooks, maps, water samples, photographs, the video documentary, and other relevant art objects and information. As with the Ice Book projects, each participant is presented with a handmade gift, usually sculpted from river clay, to express appreciation for their help with the project. To participate in both the gathering and the Ice Book projects, you have to physically be at the river and interact with others. Being aware of the plight of flowing water that is always asked to give more than it has is a call for action from each one of us, which I feel is so important. In the video documentary about the gatherings, my son Derek stands in the middle of the Rio Grande on a small sandbar and tweaks a famous quote, which we all know. Ask not what this river can do for you, but what you can do for this river.
Nice. For personal reasons, we'd like to hear about your work with Evergreen State College, where two of our kids went to school.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite schools, too.
Yeah, we like that a lot.
It's cool that your kids went there. Evergreen gave me a wonderful grant and brought me up to Washington State three times to do a gathering project along the whole length of the Nisqually River. It really was a fun time. We collaborated closely during the year-long adventure with Nisqually tribal members, salmon restoration specialists, musicians, fifth graders attending Wahilut Indian School, forest rangers, and people from Evergreen. I was given a studio on the same floor as the biologist, so some of us worked together and became close friends.
Nice.
You also create contemplation stations. These are near the riverbanks. They're built out of riverbank materials. What do these look like, and where have you placed them?
Last year, I was very fortunate to have a large retrospective at a museum in the Netherlands, and seven of the contemplation stations were created specifically for this exhibition. One was placed indoors at the end of a long reflecting pool, and the other six were placed outdoors beside local rivers so that anyone walking by could discover them. The stations were made from wooden chairs, outdoor chairs, with native grasses and willows built around the chairs to form a kind of nest where a person can sit quietly by themselves and observe the water in the stream flowing past them. They were meant to be a place of solitude and quiet and reflection.
I like the nest image, too. It sounds like a place of quiet and solitude. So where is your art and activism focused at the moment?
Ooh, this is one of the things that I just totally enjoy doing. 2 years ago, I was invited to blog for National Geographic and began to write a series of essays from the perspective of the river entitled What the River Knows. These are written in the first person from the perspective of the river itself. If we were a stream, how might we see the world? What might we know? Some of the blogs include tales told by the Ping River in Chiang Mai, Thailand, Chao Phraya in Bangkok, Thailand, the Kamigawa in Kyoto, Japan, the Siem Reap River in Cambodia, the Yaqui River in Mexico, where the eight Yaqui tribal villages do not have any water due to diversions for agricultural corporations.
Wow.
It's a really sad story about various indigenous water rights.
Right.
and the Superfund site on the Eagle River in Colorado, polluted with heavy metal runoff from the mine. And I could go on and on. There are so many. I've really enjoyed writing these.
Our Ecotopia listeners are already on board with environmental preservation, but we're always all looking for ways to engage, especially in the new Trump era. How can people connect with your work? And what should we be doing to help preserve and protect our rivers? And we are a river place, the Sacramento River, the Feather River, the Big Chico Creek, the Little Chico Creek. We are a place of rivers and creeks. We have a couple of local groups. We have more, but the Sacramento River Preservation Trust and Friends of Butte Creek are big protectors and carers for the river. What suggestions do you have for us?
Whoa, this is where I wish we had several hours this talk. So
me
too. We're running out of time. We just have a few minutes. So I'll try to make this really quick, which is hard for me.
That's okay.
I feel one way to engage is to really understand that rivers are alive. They have a body called a watershed with a mouth at the delta, organs of wetlands and riparian zones, cells, molecules of water, and like us, a circulatory system. We're not separate from the waters of the world. We each have an external watershed. Mine is the Rio Grande in New Mexico, but we also have an internal watershed composed of bodily fluids. Like us, rivers become sick. Very sick, which is to our detriment since we physically need clean water to survive. Sometimes the sickness is visible, such as when a river becomes a dumping ground, and we've all seen that. Other times, the river's illness can't be seen, but tests reveal waterborne diseases only visible through a microscope. For example, do your listeners know where their drinking water comes from? This is really important to understand and not take for granted the water coming out of the taps in our homes. A recent court decision in New Zealand and, even more recently, in India, recognizes rivers as living beings with the same rights as a person. It would indeed be fantastic here in the United States if we had this same deep, deep appreciation for our rivers.
Absolutely.
We are about out of time, and we'd like to have you back on the program again sometime in the future, and we can talk for hours more.
I love that.
We really appreciate your work, Basha Erland. Check out, listeners, go to her website, because you really still have to look at the various artworks that she does, the ice books, the contemplation locations, and so forth. Her website is BASIAIRLAND.com, BashaErland.com. Check that out. We'll also post that on our website. Thank you so much for being with us tonight on Ecotopia.
Thank you. I really appreciated it.
Thank you.
Good night.
You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and tonight our theme is art and activism. We're exploring how works of art can do more than simply hang on the wall or hang out in a museum. And we want to learn how art can inform, motivate, and mobilize environmental activists. With us on the phone now from Caledon, Ontario, Canada, is Corey Trepanier, an artist, explorer, filmmaker, who has carried his easel into some of the most remote regions on our planet to create remarkable oil paintings of Canada's wilderness. Really remarkable.
The culmination of a decade-long project, his Into the Arctic exhibition tour, is now bringing his collection of over 50 Arctic oil paintings and three films to museums across the United States. These works were created from four expeditions to the furthest reaches of the Canadian North, and they include his 15-foot-wide Great Glacier, the centerpiece of the collection, quite possibly the largest Arctic landscape painting in Canada's history. Welcome, Corey Trepanier.
It is my pleasure, and thank you very much for having me on this evening.
Yeah.
One of us will start by asking.
One of us is going to ask you to tell us a little bit about your background. You went to art school and had a successful career as a freelance commercial illustrator, and then you started to shift your focus to your fine art career. Tell us about that decision and how you came to devote your life to exploration and to landscape painting, which I'm grateful that you did, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, you know, I had been painting mostly airbrush illustrations for magazines and ad agencies for about a decade, having done that right out of college, and got married, had kids, and found myself in the studio an awful lot, really all the time, because most of these jobs are done in-house. Our daughters were quite young. They were about 2.5 and 5 years old, and I had started to pick up my oil paints again in between commissions, commercial commissions, and really starting to go back outside and reconnect with nature more closely. As when I was a child, I spent a lot of time goofing around outside and educating myself that way and getting inspired. And that kind of led to a point where, I really, really not only wanted to, as an artist, start pursuing my own paintings, seriously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd been inspired by a trip to Lake Superior to do a commission for the Ministry of Natural Resources in Ontario, and it was a painting, an oil painting, they turned into a poster, and I saw this region of Lake Superior, about 13 hours north of us, for the first time, was so blown away by the incredible landscapes there. I said, I've got to go back for all these reasons of not just pursuing my own stuff, but I also wanted our daughters to get a sense of what it's like out there. And so we kind of did the big break around 2000, 2001. I launched a project called Coast to Canvas, the goal to go back to Lake Superior, and this time to do my own paintings. We brought the girls in tow. They were, like I said, 2.5 and 5, and my wife and I spent about a month in each season canoeing and camping and painting and documenting it all with a little camcorder, which led to our very first film. And that kind of really opened the door for me to what I've been doing ever since, and what I hope to be doing the rest of my life.
Nice.
We want to hear some more about some of those treks and how you manage them, but we've also looked at your paintings. They're almost photographically precise, though they also have, to my way of thinking, a really warm glow to them, so they light up the landscape, not just record us. Tell us a little bit about your style as a painter. You mentioned airbrushing first as a commercial illustrator, and I can see some traces of that in your work, but how do you go about doing that? But maybe you could tell us about the Great Glacier painting.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that connection between my airbrush illustration and my fine art, because when I initially painted in oils, I painted a lot more loosely, to be honest, because at the same time, I really wanted to get away from the airbrush, and then I packed away my airbrush. And I think this desire in me to texture and render and sort of bring a sense of reality, into the paintings and most importantly, try to place a viewer in my place out there sort of led to me and oftentimes tightening up on my work a bit more. That said, the larger the paintings, if you look at them closely, they are quite loose, especially when it comes to Great Glacier. So Great Glacier, this 15-foot-wide painting, is the largest I've ever done. It is depicting an incredible glacier called Coronation Glacier on the northeast side of Baffin Island, which is the northeast side of Canada, up in the Arctic. And it is the centerpiece of my Into the Arctic traveling exhibition. Over the four expeditions I did to the Arctic, and maybe I should give a bit of context to Great Glacier, Into the Arctic is a project I began in 2006 to paint the Canadian Arctic. Those four expeditions were designed to try to give me an opportunity to create a body of work that can hopefully really give a fair representation of many facets of the North. And it's so big up there. I said, there's no way you could do this in a weekend or one trip. And so I set about to go as far west, far east, far north and south, and most recently across the central Arctic and other places in 2015 on my 9-week-long expedition. And from all of these paintings, probably close to 100, Great Glacier had all the elements visually as an artist that that I really want to bring together. I started a small piece on location, about 16 inches wide. I began it from a boat that I traveled with an Inuit gentleman by the name of Billy Arnakuk out of Kikitarjuaq. We went out, just him and his dog and myself, and we spent time around the glacier for several days. A real key component to any of my work is trying to experience it firsthand, and hopefully in, that will lead to paintings that can share that experience more authentically with the viewer. And then we, I sat in his boat while he was having tea on shore and pushed off a little, and just to get the right perspective, which is kilometer-high mountains and the face of a glacier that's 3-4 kilometers wide, and in the far distance, the Penny Ice Cap that covers a vast part of Baffin Island. And so that little 16-inch painting I began on location from his boat that evening, I knew very well would not be the end of it. And therefore, I came home and I stretched this really large canvas in hopes that when people stand in front of it, they can really, like I say, get a sense of what it's like to be in the Arctic. The physical aspect of the process of doing that 15-footer, well, it started 6 years ago when I stretched the canvas. And in the background, kept working on it here and there between other pieces, and finally got it all together. It was a lot of backing up from the painting and a lot of sore shoulder time over the months it took to do it.
You have a video for the Into the Arctic project, and we'll get that website and post that on our own website so our listeners can check it out. But it shows you out in a canoe painting, also shows you hauling a lot of stuff out into the wilderness. Could you give us a little narrative of how that works, backpacking, maybe snowshoeing, going out into really some wild territory?
Oh, for sure. So the probably the worst of it was on Ellesmere Island, which is very, very northern tip of North America. And in that particular location is a national park of Canada called Kitternapak National Park. You're about 500 miles shy of the North Pole at that point. One of my expeditions, I went there for a month as part of a longer trip, and my brother came with me. And, of course, the plan was to have three of us to share the load, but the other fellow couldn't join us for a full month, so we said, well, let's just go, the two of us, but we'll take all the gear for the three of us. Because in addition to camping gear, I bring my easel, which is number one on the list. Well, I guess food's kind of handy, too, but and my easel and my oil paints, all of that weighs about 25 pounds. And then we bring camping gear, and we bring food, which my wife usually has spent an enormous amount of time slaving over for a month before an expedition, dehydrating into breakfast, lunch, and dinner meals that, you know, with labels on them so that we can just pull them out no matter how delirious we are and be able to eat still. And then, of course, all our filming gear, because there's so much that happens on these journeys aside from the act of painting that I got into a habit years ago of documenting my expeditions and turning them into documentaries for television. And so the result and the of all of that was 120 pounds on my back for the first 10 days of my trip on Ellesmere Island. My brother equally took the same load. We didn't get very far. We'd maybe go half a mile at a time, and we'd have to stop, and we'd have to carry on. We'd have to stop and carry on. It was exhausting. But we brought everything we had, and, you know, as a result, we said, we're going to use everything we got. We used our jib. We used the underwater camera. We used everything. But really, it's all in an effort to try to share these incredible wilderness places that the more I've traveled up into the north, the more I realize how difficult it is and how few people will experience it firsthand. And so I really hope through my work as an artist and a filmmaker to create a window that others can experience these places through. And that has become more and more sort of, I guess, part of my mission statement as an artist.
So the Great Glacier, I want to go back a little bit because I'm still trying to get my head around this 15-foot painting. The Great Glacier was started in, like, did you say 2006?
Well, is that, let me see, 2000, oh, my mistake,
when
6 years ago is what I meant.
Oh, 6 years ago. It's probably my mistake.
2007 was the expedition that I began the study on.
Okay.
And so, in actual fact, I began the study, then a few years later, I stretched the canvas, and now I've finished the canvas in this past December, finally.
So, do you photograph it and work from a photograph and...
It's a combination.
Okay.
And so I'll begin everything I possibly can on location.
Right.
Generally speaking, on a 12-inch by 16-inch panel. It'll be generally linen mounted onto Baltic mm-hmm. birch, and I have a box that I can place 10 of those in. There's 5 slots, so I can place them back-to-back with the space so they don't touch each other. And so many of my paintings, I'd say out of every 10, I start probably 8 or 9, just get finished at that size. But there's mm-hmm. always some of these views that I just want to do bigger. And so mm-hmm. I'll complete the small study I've begun on location. In oils, I just start right away with my oil paints right onto the bare canvas, and then use that as a stepping stone towards the larger piece. Not only does it help as an aid to say, first of all, do I want to spend months on this scene that I've just kind of done a small painting of, but oftentimes the big scene will change as well as a result
right.
of going through that process.
Right.
We're talking with artist Corey Trepanier up in Canada, in Ontario. We wanted to ask you about art and activism as well, Corey. Your projects are multimedia. You do film, you do painting, you do public engagement, you do media work. Could you give us a little bit of an idea of that mix and what are and your aims in trying to reach a public and make them aware of these great wilderness places?
Well, you know, more and more. Of course, initially, as I began my career as an artist, and this to any artist who might be listening, you know, there is a component of it initially that was, okay, if people don't see my work, how am I ever going to make a living at it? I've got young children mm-hmm. to feed, and so I've got to engage with media and all that kind of stuff and try to share the work on a wider scale. But alongside that, I started to see, and of course, I've always been very strong on the environment and wanting to carry that message. But I think in the last few years of seeing that, in fact, reaching out to the public through those ways, through my films and everything else, has actually brought back some very heartfelt, reactions and responses to my work, has encouraged me that, in fact, maybe there is a role that art can play beyond just hanging on the wall and enhancing someone's own life and their own environment. And because initially, you know, you do this, you hope that perhaps, you know, especially when I started out, that, you know, this is moving me personally. It's a personal engagement with nature, and I want to share that. But I don't know if it's really going to have any kind of impact. And so it's taken years for me to really see that that is starting to happen more and more. And then I start to encounter stories of people like Thomas Moran and how his work in, you know, the Yellowstone region before it became a national park inspired Congress to set up the first national park in North America, and I think it was maybe even the world. And today I travel some of these remote national parks in Canada that have a legacy tracing all the way back to this artist and Ansel Adams, whose work has inspired mm-hmm. a generation or more to connect and appreciate the wilderness. And so all these other avenues that you mentioned, the media, the films, and so on, I see more and more as I go forward in my career. I'm still, I'd like to think, pretty young. I'm 48. I'm trying to find more yeah. and more ways that these can be used to that end. Because I really believe that the beginning of any kind of change for or protection of wild places begins with people having a passion for it. And how do they have a passion for it unless they care for it? And unless they can actually see it and get a sense of what it's about, then you know, where does that come from? So I hope in some way my work can serve the role of inspiring some of that. And all I know is myself, when I'm out there, it moves me to the core. And the more I can put into my work and the more I can put into my films along those lines, the hope is that it'll engage more people to get engaged with what's happening environmentally in all these places, but also personally, to maybe step out the door and step into the wilderness themselves and experience it. Because that's the most powerful experience, I think, to really, I guess, get people on board, if you will, with the idea that the environment really matters, is when they've personally experienced it themselves. So I guess I'm trying to give them a taste of it through what I do.
We don't mean, in fact, to diminish at all the importance of having art in galleries and on display, but you also mentioned your films. You've had national audiences, CBC and other outlets for your films. Probably reach a lot more people that way. Wonder if you could talk a little bit about your feelings of that, the films versus painting versus other ways of reaching larger numbers of people.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, I always had an interest in film when I was younger, though I never pursued it until I started bringing the camera into the wilderness with me. And it seems to be a combination. I mean, what I find most when people respond to my work, whether it's through film screenings, I think we did an 11-city film screening with Into the Arctic 2. It was nominated for a Canadian Screen Award by us up here, but it was also, we showed it a number of places, including in Las Vegas at the Plein Air Convention, put on by the Plein Air magazine out there. And I think the common thread of what I found is this combination of my passion for painting captured on film, and, of course, the massive amount of beautiful wilderness that I try to share through that is something that's never really been done before in film that I've seen. And there's a lot of films about the environment, about the scientific side, about, you know, different things like that. But there's not too many people, if any, who are actually combining sort of this all these things together. And I think it kind of creates a bit of a human conduit, if you will, when people see somebody be enthusiastic about something and to be moved by it, then it can maybe rub off in a way that's a little more direct. I mean, it's more, the films are personal because they're my story, but at the same time, I hope they're not so introspective that they only, you know, they only speak of what's between my ears, that they can really reach out to other people so that they can place themselves in there and educate them. And through the, and in addition to the journeys, this, you know, my films encompass the people I encounter, the Inuit that I've had the privilege of traveling with firsthand, going out with Sam and Jake over, you know, up the coast of Baffin Island or other places in the Arctic. And so opening and educating people on not just the wilderness, but the people who call this their backyard, literally, in the north. And because I think it's the other side of that is how important it is to take into consideration, you know, their views on the north when it comes to decision making in the south about what we think should happen up there. So yeah, it's all those things, and I just hope that that by putting everything I have into it, that it'll connect with some people on some level. And it's been really rewarding to especially have on occasion some folks come up to me in tears, saying that, you know, like, I'm especially moved when it's some older folks who maybe I know physically or health-wise will never be able to go there. Mm-hmm. And I've had some people come up to me and sort of say, you know, thank you for taking me there because I'll never go there. And so it's just been a real reward for me to go beyond just the act of painting and marrying it together with the film and all. And if the film eclipses what I do as an artist, well, I never really can, because, to be honest, you know, because it does. My art is a common thread through the film, so I don't just make films separate from my art. They're all intertwined. So whatever works, whatever helps get the message out.
Yes, absolutely. So here in the U.S., we are deeply concerned about our administration's disregard of environmental concerns, from climate change to stream protection to coal mining. Do you have any of that sort of, I don't know if it's movement backwards, yes it is, of environmental engagement in Canada or environmental protections?
Well, yeah, you know, I was online today, and I heard the not so wonderful news today about them trying to repeal a lot of things with the Clean Climate Act. Or I may not have the name right, but anyway, more repeals of things that are, you know, positive for the environment that are taking place just as even as of today. I think our government is quite in tune lately with our new government. We had a previous government that was definitely much more, pro-corporatism and so on. Our new government is certainly more in line with the importance of the environment. Obviously, Mr. Trudeau has a legacy of that with his father and in national parks that he set up as a previous prime minister years ago. I mean, they did one thing that I think is fantastic this year. They made, as part of Canada's 150th anniversary, which we are now celebrating in 2017, they've offered free access to everyone and anyone to our national parks.
Nice.
And so they've cut all the fees. And yes, it's a government stance that's going to cost the government a lot of money here from one end, of course, in the fees, but I think it's fantastic because it's going to allow especially younger people for whom just getting to one of the parks is an expense. Maybe it'll drop that barrier a little bit that they can get out there and get a taste of it for themselves, or people who are coming to our country for the first time. And I think that's a very positive move that we're seeing, you know, in just one small way that I'm really pleased to see. But there's always, everybody can always do better, that's for sure.
Yeah.
There seems like some opportunity to paint the Alberta tar sands. That's a joke.
Well, you know,
a bad joke.
Yeah,
but
well,
yeah.
Well, I mean, one could make a statement about that painting there for sure. Yeah, you know, it's such a... I find that it's one of the challenges in all this is I've got an iPhone. You know, I've got a car. I mean, as human beings, we are consumers. We consume, no matter how little we try to make an impact. The biggest question is how do we balance all that, and how do we find that right action? I mean, I know, you know, I've met in the Arctic people who work in the mining industry, and I've met other people who work in the, you know, shipping. And shipping is, I mean, the big thing across the Northwest Passage. Shipping is taking place more and more as things melt, and it's not going to lessen up, and there's already many, many big ships going through there, not just tourist ships, which are often smaller, which I think have a huge benefit because they leave their footprints very small, but they can allow people to experience the Arctic that maybe would never experience any other way. So there's a lot of issues at hand, and I'm just a tiny little voice, and I hope in some way, like I say, it can get people to consider these issues more seriously. I mean, for example, when we started the project in 2006, I remember distinctly a couple of people making fun and saying, oh, you're going to paint the Arctic. Bring lots of white paint. I mean, in Canada, there's as little knowledge about our own Arctic in Canada as there would be probably down where you're at in a lot of cases. A lot of people are very naive because it's just, yes, we're an Arctic nation, but people are disconnected.
Yeah.
Where will people be able to see your work on exhibit here in the U.S.? Do you have your venues set at this point, or is this still in progress?
Well, we have the first 2 years booked solid. So the exhibition just launched, and this is a real privilege, at the Embassy of Canada in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And speaking of the current administration, it was quite an experience for me to be in D.C. four times in the course of January and February for the exhibition setup, the reception, and other things. Mm-hmm. And just to see all that going on, for me as a Canadian, it's not something I've ever been to in Washington much before. And so we had it at the embassy, and a number of people in Washington were invited out to the reception by our embassy, and so hopefully that'll leave a small mark there in some way. It's currently in Kansas at the Dane G. Hansen Museum in Logan. In June, it moves to Arizona, to the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum. And then in the fall, it's up in Traverse City, Michigan. The rest of the list is on our intothearctic.ca website. It's then moving on to Wisconsin and Montana, and then Spokane, Washington. And we are currently, so that takes us through to the beginning of 2019, to May of 2019. And we're actively seeking other potential venues. We'd love to bring the Canadian Arctic down to California. So may indulge any of your museum-related listeners to perhaps have a look at what we're doing, because it'd be wonderful to bring it down there. And then we're exploring the possibility of trying to bring it to Europe, too. We'll see, to maybe share the Canadian Arctic with some other Arctic nations out there. See how far we can go.
Right, listeners, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I was going to mention that there are currently about 50 paintings on tour. I'm not done painting the Arctic yet, though. I've got another dozen pieces I'm finishing right now that will join the tour. And I'm also finishing Into the Arctic 3, which will be the completion of my film trilogy from the Arctic, which will be ready a little bit later on this year, and people can follow all this stuff on Facebook and whatnot as well on my page there.
There are several, at least two websites you can check, listeners, www.intothearctic.ca and also www.trepanier.shop. I'll spell that TrepanierShop.com, where you can see some of Corey's paintings and some of the early sketches that led to those paintings.
And the Facebook page is just your name?
It's The Fine Art of Corey Trepanier. Corey Trepanier Facebook. You'll find it.
Okay,
If you go to my website, there's lots of links on there to Facebook. But facebook.com/Corey Trepanier, now that I've had time to look it up myself.
Okay, good, yeah. We get it accurately.
Hey, one last thing out as an idea. I'm very excited. It's not on our website yet, so people have to stay tuned, but in 2018, my wife and I, Janet, will be hosting a trip to the Arctic. One of our major sponsors of the exhibition tour itself, Into the Arctic, is One Ocean Expeditions. They're helping to share the Arctic with others, and in 2018, we'll be joining 80 or 90 guests in the Arctic for 12 days. More details will come on that, but there's no better way to really get a taste of the Arctic and to see what's at stake up there than to be out there yourself in one of the most magnificent parts. It's going up the coast of Baffin Island in that same area that Great Glacier was done in. It'll be a fascinating trip.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. Thank you, Corey Trepanier. Oh, Trepanier, for being with us on Ecotopia this evening. We love your paintings. People should really look online and the film of the Great Glacier. It's really wonderful stuff. And for the environmental awareness that is emerging from your work. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much. And I do encourage everyone to step outside, go feel the grass between your toes.
Right. Right.
Thank you, Corey. Mm-hmm. Good night.
Take care. Thanks much.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Star Community Credit Union, a division of Members First Credit Union, serving Chico residents for 50 years. Star Community Credit Union offers checking, savings, credit loans, credit cards, and loans, complemented by their exceptional member service. Star Community Credit Union now serves Butte, Glen, Chasta, and Tehama counties, and can be reached at membersonline.org or by calling 800-303-3838. And we're also brought to you by Garden Connection, providing everything you need for year-round growing of any kind. Garden Connection specializes in sun systems and hydroform lighting and carries hydroponic and organic supplies. Garden Connections is open 7 days a week and is located at 629 Entler, just off Highway 99 in South Chico. More information is available by calling 342-7762.
Coming up momentarily on KZFR, The Storyteller with Natalie Harris, and she'll be reading about kites this evening. And at 7:30, Senor Felipe with LA Sounds. This has been Ecotopia on KZFR. Thanks very much for listening.